5th Floor, Justice Department. This week on Hulu, the long-awaited premiere of The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox. The 8-part series takes us back to 2007 when Amanda, just weeks into a study abroad program in Italy, came home from spending the night at her boyfriend's apartment only to discover there had been a break-in. They called the police, and Amanda's roommate, Meredith Kircher, was found stabbed to death in her locked bedroom. You know the rest, of course. Amanda and her boyfriend, Raffaele, became suspects, went to trial, were convicted, and spent 4 years in prison before the wheels of justice finally began to turn in their favor. Amanda and Raffaele were fully exonerated by Italy's version of our Supreme Court. But it took 8 years in a harsh international media spotlight to get to that final exoneration. I'm Jeff Hoyt. This is Hoytus Interruptus. Here with me in the studio is Cindy Hoyt.
Hello.
And our friends and island neighbors, both of whom will be depicted in this twisted tale, Christopher Robinson.
Hi.
And Amanda Knox.
Hello, hello.
Good to see you guys. You've been gone a while.
Yeah, it's been quite the trip that we've been on. But it's great. It's good. We're really excited about this show, so we're excited to tell everyone and anyone about it.
We're excited about you being the first people we've ever known that had their own biographical miniseries.
Well, you know, there's still time.
Yeah. What do we have to do? Oh, we don't want to do
anything. We don't want to do what you did.
A little program note, though, if in case you're thinking, oh, the first two episodes, they're almost here, and you've been waiting for this. If you'd like, you could wait on those first two episodes and go to the Vashon Theater on August 30th, because you're going to be
7 p.m.
on the big screen.
We're doing a fundraiser for the Washington Innocence Project. We'll be screening the first two episodes. All ticket sales go to benefit the Washington Innocence Project, and we'll be doing a Q&A after the episodes with Amanda and myself.
I honestly feel like everyone should watch the first two episodes when they come out and watch them again, because they're so, like, the way that this story unfolds is, I mean, first of all, this is a 8-year long, I mean, well, the actual show encompasses nearly 20 years of my life. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot that it goes into. And I feel like even just the psychological journey of, like, the interrogation scene can be viewed more than once to appreciate all of the nuances. So I actually recommend that people watch it multiple times.
Excellent.
To
okay.
Like,
well, the details of the story kind of come at you like a fire hose, because you chose to give this kind of an Amelie sort of twist, which is the movie that you and Raffaele were watching the night of the murder.
Yeah, that was our creator and showrunner KJ Steinberg's idea. So she was trying to, we had been talking about how we didn't want this to be just a true crime biopic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we wanted this to be a really personal story. We wanted to have a much wider lens. And one of the things that she was seeking to capture is what it's like to be a young person, what it's like to have your whole life ahead of you, and how that both that sort of, you know, innocent optimism, but also, you know, naivete when it comes up against a tragic and overwhelming circumstance, it might be twisted into, you know, people misinterpret it. And she wanted to show the other side of that, which was how some of that quirky quality to me helped me survive and navigate this really overwhelming situation. So like a good example of this is, you know, she depicts my first night in prison. I'm just laying there in bed staring up at this concrete ceiling, and I wave my hand in front of my face, and the ceiling becomes a starry sky. And it's just like, you know, me
beautiful.
Trying to, like, not feel trapped in this prison cell by using my imagination. So
yeah, we wanted to depict not just the reality of the facts, but the psychological reality for the people going through this. Amanda especially, but everyone involved has their own perspective and internal mechanics at play. And so that truth is just as important as the details of the investigation.
Which were very thoroughly researched. Mm-hmm. Like, KJ and the rest of the production and writing team did years of research. They had a personal translator who was translating hundreds and, you know, at least hundreds of court documents. So like it was extremely like factual.
Yeah.
But it also allows for trying to capture a sense of whimsy that is a part of my perspective.
Well, and it's honoring the person that you were before all of this.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, you know, as you've pointed out in some of your stand-up comedy, like you were the manic pixie dream girl in
yeah.
some ways.
And but the, you know, it's not just me that gets you that the Amelie sequences get used as well, because I think the idea is that like one of the sort of big themes in this is there are facts and then there's how you view those facts.
Mm-hmm.
And that can lead to completely different interpretations of reality. And we want to like appreciate that and honor that. And, you know, so we do have like Amelie sequences from Mignini's perspective, where we get a little bit of his history and a little bit of his context. We have the same thing with Raffaele, all to sort of really solidify for the audience that everyone in this scenario is coming to the same set of facts with completely different lenses. And that is one of the reasons why everything went awry.
So it's a little Rashomon-y in that way?
I don't know.
Yes. I mean, there's, you do sometimes see the same scene repeated from a different character's POV. That's what she's referring to.
Yeah.
You should
and they experience.
Buff up on your cinema there.
Yeah, sorry. I'm like,
she hasn't
I don't
time.
Know. Yeah, when were you watching Rashomon-y?
I think you were in prison.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love the idea that everyone's perspectives are being considered.
Mm.
And
honored and yes. presented without judgment.
Right, because they're
the big thing.
Humans too.
Yeah.
To us, certainly after knowing you, some of them feel more like ogres or demons, but I mean, know they're really people.
And, you know, that's my mom's perspective.
Of course
so,
it
and
is.
Hers is represented
but,
as
you
well.
You know, like during the filming of the interrogation scene, for instance, Amanda was there on set and she was talking not just to Grace Van Patten, who's playing her, to help Grace really sit in and anchor in the psychological space that Amanda was in during that journey, an evolving space, but also she was talking to the actors playing the police and trying to help them understand where they're coming from and reminding them, hey, you've been awake for 48 hours too. You're tired. You know, this is the biggest crime that's ever rocked your city, mm-hmm. right? You think this girl is hiding some information that she's not telling you.
You don't really understand even what she's saying half the time. And so that makes you feel like she's being cagey when in fact it's because she doesn't speak the language. You know, like there's those sorts of elements.
Right.
And then of course, everyone has different perspectives in that room too. Like, and again, getting this scene right was maybe like the most important thing for me in the making of the show, because I think that interrogations, when they're represented in Hollywood and in media, they do not really convey what it is like. And in my interrogation, there were many different kinds of approaches that people had towards me. Some were really aggressive, some were really conciliatory. And we see all of that happen all at once and how it is this psychological journey mm-hmm. that everyone's character in that room goes on.
Well, others have told versions of this story, but you were never involved.
Right.
And the other versions of this story only served to perpetuate the many fictions that came out during the trial
right.
that a lot of people believed. Did you ever even imagine that you'd get to tell this story on your own terms?
Well, for the longest time, it didn't really feel like my story to tell because it was just the story of two girls go to study abroad in Perugia, Italy, and only one of them survives. And, you know, like the people who actually have agency in that story are the people who either, you know, murdered my roommate or put me in prison. Like both me and Meredith felt like we were just, what's the part of a story? Like what element yeah. of the story would we have been? We're certainly not the protagonists.
Your pawns, your victims, your MacGuffins in a way. It's like that everyone else in that tale has plot stakes, you might say, from my novelist's perspective. Like if you're, you know, what does a character want? What actions are they taking that advance the plot? Like Amanda was taking almost no actions during that whole saga
that
advanced the plot. Her lawyers took actions. Her family took actions. You know, the journalists, the media, the police and investigators all took actions that shaped the course of events. Not to say that you didn't do important things like, you know, learn Italian in prison and stand up for yourself and defend yourself in court. Like, that's an action. That's real.
Sure.
But it's minor, I think, compared to the grand shape of that saga was steered largely by other people.
Mm-hmm. And
that changed when Amanda decided to go back to Italy.
Right. So, and again, that's why this isn't just like the way that this story has been told in the past has really been limited to a like true crime, you know, courtroom drama, you know, violence, you know, tragedy kind of story. Mm-hmm. And this is way more about what do you do in the aftermath of trauma? That was something that Monica Lewinsky, who's also an executive producer on the show, and I, that was like a really huge, important part of this for us, that like, yes, you know, the worst experience of your life will happen to you, but what do you do about it? And that's what this story is really about. It starts and it ends with Amanda goes back to Italy, and to appreciate why she's going back to Italy and what she's attempting to accomplish, we have to go back in time to, you know, reveal, you know, all of the groundwork that was laid to, you know, lead her to this moment of taking agency and making a choice for herself. And then what is the, you know, what is the result? What does she get out of it? What does she not get out of it? And how can we all relate to that journey of seeking meaning and seeking reconciliation and seeking to reclaim a sense of ownership over your own life and your own story?
I would add that it's not just going back to Italy. It's going back to meet face to face with the prosecutor, the man responsible for throwing you in prison. And a part of that journey back is recognizing and giving him the benefit of the doubt that he's not a mustache twirling villain, but that he believed he was doing the right thing, even if he made tremendous mistakes and caused tremendous harm. And so a lot of what you see in the 2007 to 2011 episodes is, giving the benefit of the doubt to everyone involved, even when it seems like, especially when it seems like they don't deserve it. The cops, the investigators, the prosecutor, give them the chance to be seen as someone who is trying to do the right thing and got it wrong somehow. Because if you don't understand how that cognitive bias leads people with good intentions to commit harm, then you can't make sense of why present-day Amanda would be willing to walk into a room with the prosecutor and be kind to him.
Excellent point.
Yeah, and you know, I think this is actually really cool because of all the people who I've been interviewed about this. Like, you guys witnessed this.
Yeah.
Like, you were there for the ride.
We were some of the friends going, are you sure you want to do this?
Yeah, exactly.
I was there with your mom going, don't do it. Don't go.
Now just tell me, you're not going to get rearrested and thrown back in jail, right? And
we should have just written that scene into one of the episodes.
Yeah, well, no guarantee.
And this the series is bookended by that decision to make that trip. And and in our first conversation that we had, it was right after we first had dinner together, and then we came down here to the radio station and talked. You talked about being like a dog with a bone,
mm-hmm.
and couldn't let go. You had to know why. Why did this happen to me? Why?
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of what you were trying to find out by going back to Italy to sit down with Menini.
That's right.
And there are some things that I wonder if you will ever know the answer to, if any of us will ever know the answer to, which is why other people, members of the public, everywhere in the world, were so willing to dogpile on.
Mm, good point. Yeah. That's another big why question that we seek to address in this show. And, you know, especially, again, with, like, Monica Lewinsky as an executive producer, like, she is deeply concerned. Yeah, she has some experience mm-hmm. and some deep concerns about the dogpiling onto a person who may or may not have made a mistake, and then how that, you know, worst experience of their life becomes a defining and diminishing, you know, thing in their life.
Yeah. And it becomes the heads that turn every time you walk into the room.
And why in this particular way that we diminish women in particular, and the way that we do it, and especially by vilifying women through sexuality. That was something that she was, very interested in obviously showcasing, because this case, I think, is a very good example of that.
On the other side of her experience with her own miniseries, did she have anything to share with you, any advice?
Lots of it.
How to get through this?
Yeah, I mean, she's very much an executive producer in her own right now, which means that she knows the various different stages of development that a project like this goes in. And she was there anticipating for me ahead of time, like, hey, now we're about to enter this stage of the development process, and you might be triggered by this, this, and this. So just so you know, I'm here. Or like another example, it's just like everything from, breaking the whole story to writing the scenes and saying, okay, well, there are going to be some scenes that we have to do that are going to be embarrassing for you. So let's talk about why we want to depict one thing versus another, and how does it feel, and how are you going to feel okay about that? Because she's had to have that idea. How do you, tell a story? One thing that she's very clear about is that there's been a resistance in Hollywood to the idea of using a source as a creative partner in the development of stories. And we're really trying to push back on that and say, just because there's a source that has a creative presence in the room doesn't mean that it turns into a hagiography, right? Like, sources are very willing to own up to their, their own faults and failings. And in fact, they can bring a even deeper perspective about those kinds of things and a deeper willingness.
It depends on the source.
It depends on the source, absolutely. But
there's great benefits to be had that you just can't get from secondhand sources.
Mm. Right.
And involving the person who is at the center of something like this in the making of it just gives you insight and access to the psychological reality that I mentioned earlier, that you have to kind of guess at when you're telling a story without talking to or involving the people who were there.
And that's what elevates this from a docudrama into a dramatization.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, the beauty of a limited series is that you have 8 episodes over which to tell it, which means you can get into all kinds of details that you could never get into in a 2-hour movie.
Right.
But we know your story, and it's a big, big ass story.
It's a big ass story, yeah.
We could have done 5 seasons.
Yeah.
No kidding.
I was just thinking, how did you figure out the places where you just thought, I really want that in there, but there's just no chance? How did you?
We cried a lot.
We cried. Ultimately it was KJ Steinberg's call, because she's she's the creator of this show. She's the showrunner. But what I found and what was really gratifying and really good about this experience is that KJ and I almost always saw eye to eye on what we needed to portray. And I remember when we were originally trying to break this story, we were like, can we get 12 episodes so that we can spend a lot more time, in the aftermath of me getting out of prison? And they were like, nope, it's 8 episodes. So here's this whole story that you have about being conned and, making all these mistakes. There's just no room for it. So sorry, we can't have it in. But how do we show, what sort of really condensed version of reality can we make that suggests Amanda's isolation and Amanda's desire for human connection, but the flailing and the mistakes that she make in the process of trying to reconnect? And that's where the dramatization comes in, right? There are scenes that did not exactly happen that way in real life. It's more like conversations or conflicts that happened over time suddenly get condensed into one scene, right? Yeah. And so it's still true to the authentic experience. It's just not a strict documentary in that regard.
Exactly.
Right.
It's, I think, benefits from that.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it would all just be, it would be a 24-year movie.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So Italy is probably dreading this series. Should they?
I I don't know what Italy is thinking about with this series, but... I mean,
Italy is a big... Italy is a big word.
Yeah, it's a lot of people.
Yeah, city of
justice
Perugia.
Authorities.
Yeah, I mean, I think that...
I'll answer that.
Okay, you want to answer that? Sure.
I think dread is probably not the right word. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably more so dismissiveness and judgment. Mm-hmm. And I think similarly in the UK, mm-hmm. that type of reaction of why is this attention whore, you know, back here dredging all this up again?
Right.
What a narcissist. You know, there's that sort of attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This serves no purpose, etc. I don't think they're fearing that their corruption or incompetence is going to be exposed. Mm-hmm. If they do actually watch it in either of those places, the people who have those judgments, they'll find that Amanda and me and all the other people who've produced this have gone to great lengths to humanize and dimensionalize everyone involved,
yeah.
which I hope will pleasantly surprise them. But this is kind of related to the question we were talking about earlier, the big why question.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side of that big why is like, why do people still believe the things that they jumped the pile on that happened decades ago? Why are they still on that? And that had, I think, has a more personal answer that has to do with ego and identity, which is that for all those people who indulged in Schadenfreude for just a moment, for them to now admit that Amanda is totally innocent and blameless and not the cause of her own wrongful conviction, right? If they must admit the facts show she's innocent, many people are still like, yeah, but you acted weird and you kind of brought it on yourself, right?
Because otherwise I would have been
Otherwise, I would have been wrong. Otherwise, I would have been the monster who demonized a totally blameless girl, right? So I think there's a lot of that going on, that people are resistant to reassess. And then there's the moral paragon people who reach out to Amanda over, you know, through our website or something, and they have the guts to say, I was wrong about you and I'm sorry. And that happens.
Yeah.
You know, that's happened quite a few times already. And I expect you'll get a lot more messages like that.
You think so?
Oh,
I expect that
after this is through?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
would go so far as to say that a lot of people in England and Italy who might say, oh, I'm going to dismiss that, are going to go home and watch it. And they'll come out of it with a different perspective.
I mean, I think that, like, again, one thing maybe I'm getting a taste of this from having encountered so many incredible Italian actors in the course of making this show. You know, Francesco Acquaroli, Giuseppe De Domenico, like Roberta Mattei, like there are lots of really, really amazing actors out of Italy who are participating in this show.
And their names are fun to say.
Just
rolled right off your tongue.
Right. And I super bonded with them on set. Like I super bonded with the Italian actors who played the cops,
mm-hmm.
like, which was a bizarre experience.
That, yeah, that had to be bizarre.
It was so bizarre.
I wonder if it added to their challenge in acting.
Yeah. Actually, it did.
There was this moment on set when the woman, Roberta Mattei, is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
Playing the head of homicide. You know, we were in a courtroom. They were filming a courtroom scene, and we were kind of on set watching. And like between takes, like she's in her, you know, she's in character, right?
Yeah.
She's like in her like, I'm the head of homicide sort of character. She looks back over at Amanda on the sidelines and gives her one of those like Robert De Niro, like, you know.
I'm watching you.
I'm watching
my
you.
Eyes to yours.
Yeah.
But then we were just like laughing about it. It was so great because like, I think a lot of them were like, wow, I really learned a lot about this story that like everyone thinks they know.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks they know, especially in Italy. Everyone in Italy thinks they know the story. But once they actually dig into the facts and not just the headlines that they remember,
mm-hmm.
suddenly they are very, very shocked. And that seems to be the predominant sentiment over and over and over again that I hear from people is like, oh, like I didn't know this, I didn't know that, like, oh no.
Oh, there's so like, much, no, yeah. There's so much we didn't know over on this side of the pond.
Yeah, well, everywhere. Yeah. There's
or
so
anywhere.
Much that anywhere, like it felt like no one really had a grasp of what was really going on. They only had bits and pieces that were very carefully curated to them
uh-huh.
to portray a certain kind of story.
In order to sell newspapers.
Exactly. And so I think that people, even people who have like followed the case, you know, peripherally, like they paid attention to when it was in the headlines, will come away from this story being like, wow, there was so much more that I didn't know. And again, like we could have had five seasons worth of stuff like that. But
Well, and maybe it'll do a community service. Maybe people will not be so quick to judge in the future.
That's the ideal scenario, yes. And that like people will cut human beings a little more slack when they're in a crisis, because, you know, crisis scenarios do not necessarily bring out the best in us.
And not just people like Amanda, but the authorities too.
Yeah.
Are under immense pressure. I mean, can you imagine what it's like to do your job when people are looking over your shoulder and scrutinizing everything you do? And when the international media shows up and they're watching your every move
and they're like, demanding answers that you don't have,
the pressure just ratchets up super high, and like people make mistakes, they double down on things, they don't want to look bad. Like it's understandable why those people made the moves they made.
We see that in so many stories where the media of the world just descends on a small town because something horrific has happened. Newtown is one that springs to mind. The media was just all over that town for, it seems like, months.
They were following children home from school.
Yeah, and the authorities there really struggled with the daily news conferences and all the things that they had to do to keep people informed.
And the, why don't you have our answers yet?
Let's talk a little bit about the preparation that goes into something like this. Grace Van Patten, who plays you in the series, had to get inside your head. She had to know everything about you.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, so...
Is that the world's longest Zoom call? Or?
It's not the world's longest Zoom call. There was a few Zoom calls. Uh-huh. But honestly, I think... Well, first of all, Grace will tell you that she was already familiar with my story before she ever met me. Mm-hmm. And she really related to me, you know, back when she first saw the Netflix documentary, right? Like she had this inkling that she would want to play me one day. And when we've talked about it with each other, you know, yes, she asked me like loads of very insightful questions, like, you know, tell me about the process of you, how you, like your language, like one of the things that was so challenging for her as an actress is she had to portray various different levels of fluency in a foreign language that she herself was not fluent in. So not only did she have to learn a foreign language,
but in
she had to evolve in her own fluency over the course of the series, because my own fluency evolved over that course. So she would have discussions with me about like, okay, where are we at in your level of like competency? And are you feeling confident right now? Are you feeling less confident? Do you feel safe? Are you trying to speak Italian? Are you trying to understand? Or is your brain overwhelmed? So like lots of good questions like that. But even just like good character questions. Like I'll never forget, she asked when we were just chatting with her, like, what are some of the nonverbal ways that you and Chris communicate with each other? And I was just like, right? Great question. So she's obviously she's an actress who is very professional and has been long in the game, right? But she has great instincts. And I think that she just kind of like she said, I remember her talking about how it wasn't actually that difficult for her to sort of get into my mindset, especially the young me mindset, because like she's not that different from me. Like she's a theater kid, you know.
That realization when she was asking, you know, people say you're quirky or eccentric or whatever. Can you like tell me about that? Like, what do they mean when they say that? And Amanda just said, well, I mean, did you ever hang out with the drama club in high school?
And she was like oh,
yeah.
Right? I mean, like, so much gets made of Amanda being an eccentric. It's like, you know, she wasn't any more eccentric than the theater nerd kids in your high school.
Yeah.
The kids who did Glee Club. Like, that was Amanda. She was optimistic, and she sang, and she
and liked
skipped
to wear
through
costumes
the hallways and liked to dress up and, you know.
And was lots unembarrassed of people by flamboyant behavior.
Yeah, exactly, right?
You know.
Oh, man, that must have been a revelation.
But another important point here is that Grace is also bringing herself to this. It's not just mimicking Amanda down to her minute, you know, body movements and her
although
inner psychology.
Although she did use, mm-hmm. she did do my snort at
she
one point.
She did manage to copy Amanda's snort laugh. It's true.
Which that had to be an accomplishment in itself.
I mean, yeah. She just noticed that I snorted. And then I started getting called. I was nicknamed the snort on set by one of the, like, producer people.
The snort. Here comes
That's
the snort.
Great.
Ah, we got a snort off to the left. We didn't
watch
need to
out.
Let's try that again. Chris, what was it like to see actors auditioning for the role of Chris?
That was fun. That was so fun.
I mean, I assume this is the only time in my life this is ever going to happen. Who knows? Maybe we'll have a biopic just about me one day. But yeah, I mean, like 30 different, you know, audition tapes come in of people reading a scene that is a meet cute between me and Amanda drinking whiskey and talking about Star Trek.
It was so good. Right? I was so happy with
that
it.
That scene doesn't end up in the actual show.
Uh-huh.
We have room for it, but it was bizarre.
was and, it easy you know, for you to tell who was closer and
I mean,
who was
oh, yeah.
not?
I think one of the things you realize is that how little of a person actually gets conveyed in the script, in a way, because you give 30 different actors the same material, and they each bring it to life in a different way. Mm-hmm. And uh-huh. some people were great actors who just had an interpretation or a vibe that was just totally off
right.
the like, direction that we were going.
Yeah.
They made him more like, you know, timid or like quiet, more like librarian than,
mm-hmm. you know,
slam and poet.
Do you remember the audition specs?
Did they send you those? Yes. There's a little description of the character and what their attitude is like. They give them something to go off
uh-huh.
of.
Yeah.
And anyway, the guy we liked from the beginning, Jared Canfield, his take was just right. And it felt like he, and I think, I don't remember if I asked him this, but I think he went on to like Instagram and was like looking at pictures and videos of me. Internet stalked me a little bit.
Good.
Which he should have.
It's called research.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and what about your mom? How did she feel about the casting call for her role?
I mean, who doesn't want to be played by Sharon Horgan?
Come on. Which now everybody knows from Bad Sisters.
Yes, and everyone's hit. Like, you know, crush. The over 50 crush of this, you know, decade is Sharon Horgan.
She also has, you know, she's Irish and has this Irish accent. Uh-huh. And she has to speak in an American accent for this role. And it was so funny watching her on set she's in her American accent. And then if she forgot a line or something, or if the, you know, take had to stop, you'd hear her just like immediately slip out and go, oh, bollocks, you know.
Back to the Irish.
Yeah.
But she was great because, like, you know, she's known for her comedic roles, and this one is an extremely dramatic one.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, she and Grace have such good chemistry on, you know, on the stage, on the set together. And there are some really beautiful mother-daughter scenes. The relationship between me and my mom is a huge one that is developed over the course of the series that comes across its own challenges, just like, you know, we're tracing my relationship with Giuliano Magnini and how it developed over time.
Let's turn back to that, the trip to Italy that kind of bookends the series.
Mm-hmm.
And it started out because you gave a speech over there in which you said that you would like to know who this man is and sit down and talk with him. And I guess he reached out after that.
Right. So, yeah, I originally reached out to him through a couple of letters.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to Italy for the first time in real life for this justice conference thing where I gave a public talk about trial by media and about misrepresentation. And I noted that he was also very likely misrepresented by the media over the course of this whole case.
Mm-hmm.
And so just as I wanted to be seen and understood, I wanted to see and understand him. And I reiterated that desire to encounter him in person. And he felt like after that, he was sort of honor bound to at least respond to my letters and was moved, was genuinely moved by my take, which wasn't the obvious defensive and angry and retributive take.
Right.
So
you go, and we remember when you left,
mm-hmm.
And
were you worried if I was coming back?
No. You reassured us.
I was a little.
Yeah. At first, but you went, and this had to be an astounding thing to go back to Perugia for the first time, because when that first trip to Italy, you didn't go back to Perugia. But you go back to Perugia, and it's for both of you, because Chris, you weren't a part of this back then. So you are seeing these places.
This was all BC.
The prison, the house, the town, just where you were, you know, where you had this happy-go-lucky experience until it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to know what that was like, and and also talk a little bit about the drive between the prison and the courtroom, which you never got to see at all.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you know, that was one of the more uncanny moments for me, was now I'm either in the driver's seat, literally, or I'm in the back seat, you know, hanging out with Eureka while we're driving through these beautiful countrysides. And the only way that I had ever known them was from a closed-in, you know, steel box cage.
No windows.
In the back, of a back of a prison truck, prison van. And
as you put it, you felt like you were a UPS package.
Yes. Yeah. It was very UPS package vibes. And so it was shocking to me just how beautiful it was. And then, you know,
olive
these winding
groves,
hills, sunflower fields,
crenellated castles on the hill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then bam, all of a sudden, concrete walls, barbed wire. And we stopped to take a look at it from the outside in a way that I never was able to, because even when I was first brought there, like, I was in the back of a police car and they had put a hat over my head and made me put my head between my knees until we were through the prison gates and I was taken out. So, like, I never had seen the prison from the outside before. And I had this long moment of just staring at it and marveling at how I had lost 4 years of my life to this scar in the otherwise beautiful countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of overwhelmed with sort of anger on behalf of my younger self and the mental gymnastics that I had to do in order to be okay, especially post conviction where I was facing 26 years. Like, it did not escape me that if things had gone another way, I would have still been in there and still would have had a lot of time to go. So,
and there were people that you knew that were still in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That scene is not in the upcoming Hulu series, but it is in Amanda's. I think Amanda talks about that in her book, Free: My Search for Meaning.
Yep.
There's another scene that I wonder, and this is, I'm not sure if you want to, I'm making this point, we might want to edit it out. I don't know. The thing that we don't see in the movie, in the series, is something that you mentioned one time, and I had not known. And that is that part of the happy-go-lucky, the innocence at the beginning when you were first arrested and you were making out with Raffaele in police station. Was it the police station?
It was outside.
Yeah. So making out is a very heavy term, but yes,
shared a few chaste kisses. Yeah.
Okay.
Didn't look like making out to me.
Anyway.
I saw the video.
Not having the same serious demeanor as the two characters who were playing your roommate did. And it's come back to me over and over again that they judged you for your actions because they had seen Meredith, her body.
Mm.
But you had never seen her body.
Right.
Which it feels to me like that would have changed your demeanor.
Mm.
That would have
sure, yeah. I think I would have been
sobered anyone up.
I think I would have been more on the hysterical range of things if I had actually witnessed the actual crime scene with my own eyes, and I didn't. And that is something that is shown in the series. Like you don't
see. I've still only seen the first episode.
Yeah, well, so in the series, you see everything that leads up to the police breaking in the door and revealing. And so you as the audience do not see the crime scene. Like we're very, very sensitive about like protecting Meredith in that way. Like you don't see it, but you see the people who see it, their reaction. Mm-hmm. And they have a very strong reaction to it.
And then it's very intentional that you see Amanda down the hallway looking confused, not seeing into the bedroom.
Right. And then you see, this is one of those scenes where it's Rashomani, where like there are multiple times that you see when people first encounter this horrific scene. You see them reacting to it. And you also see when I'm reacting to it, it's like I'm in a tunnel where all of these Italian speakers are speaking over each other. And there's this kind of like zoom out of the lens where I'm just like, you see everyone talking and then it sort of zooms out on me and everything just sort of becomes blurry and underwater sounding. So like there's a big filter between me and the rest of the people and their ability to understand what's going on. And so we show that.
Yeah, tracking that knowledge, who knows what, when, mm-hmm. is a subtle thing, but a very important thing that we, that KJ was very attuned to, that was important to us. And so in the pilot, in the first episode, you'll see this if you pay attention carefully, that when Amanda learns what's happened to Meredith, like it's not in that moment when the door is kicked down, when she's outside of the house, that famous photo of her and Raffaele holding each other and they share a few kisses, like she doesn't know in that moment. Philomena is over there wailing, which, you know, from a...
one of the roommates.
From hindsight, you would say, oh, well, shouldn't it be obvious? Someone's wailing. Obviously, there's someone died in there. But, you know, when you're 20 and you're confused and it's a foreign language and you've never been anywhere near something that violent and horrific and shocking, you make any excuse you can to try and cling on to. You're in that, it's the classic stages of grief. It's mm-hmm. denial. Right? Mm-hmm. You're in that space of like, there's got to be another explanation for what happened.
This
can't be true. And when you don't actually know the information because you didn't see in that room, right? And then later in the police station, there's a scene where the Amanda character asks one of the cops, like, was it really Meredith in there? And the cop tells her yes. And you know, she says, how did she die? And she says, slaughtered. And you see Amanda finally sort of grapple with that brutal fact. And then immediately after that, there's this encounter between her and the British girls, Meredith's friends. And this is a famously much scrutinized moment where the British girls said Amanda was cold and strange. And, you know, they said, do you think she suffered? And Amanda said, of course she fucking suffered. They slit her throat. Right? And what people didn't realize is the context of that is like, 30 seconds ago, Amanda had just finally learned what had happened and was mm-hmm. sitting, was in that shock. Mm-hmm. And then these other friends are still in that place of denial, like, I hope she didn't suffer. You know, so like that created this moment of disconnect that led those British girls to judge her. Because again, people aren't tracking who knows what when. Mm-hmm. Even like one of the things that really shocked me is that, I don't know if this is in the series, I don't remember, but like at one point the cops like just threw down some autopsy photos, some crime scene photos when they were talking to Amanda in the interrogation room. And, or was this in when you were already in prison?
This is when I was already in prison. Yeah. So, and this isn't in the series, but a real thing that happened at one point was, and it wasn't the police, it was my own attorneys.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So my own attorneys were curious about some of the objects that were found in Meredith's room. And so they were asking me like, hey, we want to show you a few pictures so that you can like tell us, you know, why is this lamp on the floor? That like that kind of thing. And so they start flipping through these photos and then all of a sudden there she is, Meredith, like mm-hmm. at the crime scene. Like
the this, first time you've
the
ever
first
seen
time
it.
I've ever seen it. And I see her wounds and I freak the fuck out. And I'm like, I have a complete and utter meltdown. Like I'm sobbing hysterically and they're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And so the guards come and they take me to go take me back to my cell. They were going to actually take me to the doctor to see if I needed like some kind of, you know, psychiatric whatever. And one of the guards was like, what is going on? Like what happened? And I said, well, they just showed me a picture of Meredith's body. And they're like, well, why is that upsetting to you? You've already seen it. Like just the assumption between this, you know, police, you know, this prison guard and me was like, here I am in like a state of hysterics and shock. And the guard's like, what are you talking about? Like, you're the one who did that in the first place. Like, what do you mean they showed you a picture of her body? Like you were there, you know, like they were. And so they like the idea that that could have been the first time that like I saw what had been done to her was just like beyond their imagination. And so, of course, from their lens, they view my reaction in a very different way.
Yeah. Well, just about any reaction you had to anything along the entire course of that case was interpreted as a sign of guilt, it seemed.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and I think that that's something that I'm still struggling with to this day is this like impulse coming from people who want to find fault in me, like who just want to find something wrong with me. So that I can be to blame. Like this is something that we mentioned before.
And so that they can be right.
Yeah. Or so that they don't have to feel as bad. Like there's this sort of unspoken agreement among many people out there that like we have to find something wrong with Amanda because otherwise reality is just too bad.
Harsh.
It's just too bad to admit. Like it can't be that bad.
It's honestly, I don't think it's that different than the people who cling to 9/11 conspiracy theories. You know, like you want the world to make sense. Mm-hmm. And when a random group of terrorists can somehow perpetrate a thing that destructive and get past all of our intelligence and all these things, that's a lot scarier that this ragtag group can defeat our best resources than it is, weirdly, that some inside job is what led to it.
Right. Yeah. You know? Dastardly.
Yeah.
Illuminati inside our own government pulled this.
At least we could expect them to be able to get past it, you know. So
like once again, we're down to people.
Has Manini gotten to see any of this series yet?
Not yet.
He's about to experience it himself.
Yeah.
How does he feel about the fact that it's happening?
He's nervous, obviously. He's been reading all of the reviews and articles about it in the lead up and telling me his take on those reviews. But he also says that he trusts me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's right to trust me because I think that we give him a lot of benefit of the doubt and we give him a lot of credit in this show.
We don't let him off the hook.
We don't let him off the hook.
Well, no, because he made up stuff out of thin air.
Yeah.
That was very, very damaging.
Yes. Yes. But we try to show how his context and how his history was a lens through which he interpreted reality. And the ongoing debate that I have with him to this day is me trying to get him to be able to distinguish between what is a fact and what is an opinion. So, you know, a good example of this is he looks at the crime scene and, you know, we depict this in the show and he immediately concludes that here's a broken window. This is a break-in, but
here's a rock on the floor.
Here's a rock on the floor. He takes one look, and so he looks at all of these facts. Here's the broken window. Here's the rock on the floor. Here's, you know, the glass scattered everywhere. And he concludes that this is a staged break-in because, in his opinion, no burglar would have tried to enter our house through that window. They would have tried some other window. And therefore, it is a staged break-in.
And therefore, someone who lives in the house is connected to the crime.
So these conclusions that he arrives at which are opinions. They are interpretations of facts. To him, are facts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like the constant sort of, and I think this is why the story is so interesting in a broader perspective, especially at a time when so many of us are concerned about misinformation and about, you know, alternative truths and all of that. Like, one of the issues at play is that a lot of people cannot distinguish between what is a fact and what is an opinion, what is an interpretation of facts.
Which makes this the perfect time for this particular story to be told, I would think.
I would think so, too.
It seems incredibly timely.
It's very timely, despite having, in reality, happened nearly 20 years ago. But, like, I think it was the beginning, truly, of misinformation and misinterpretation imposing itself on reality being a real
thing. And not just that, but I think one of our goals for this was for it to be universal in other ways as well, particularly in what it feels like to be trapped in your own life and to feel like you have no control over where your life is going. Mm-hmm. And how do you reclaim a sense of agency and purpose in your life? And like, what can you gain and what do you risk when you walk right towards the scariest thing? That's stuff that everyone deals with in some capacity. And so one of our big hopes is that people don't see this just as Amanda's journey, but they can see themselves in it, or see their own personal dilemmas and fears and opportunities to confront the things in their life in what Amanda did by going back to Italy.
Which also will possibly make people assumption or challenge their own assumptions that everything happens for a reason.
Mm.
Because that's something that needs to be looked at.
Yeah.
Do you still harbor any hopes that a door could open to the Kirchers?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
To Meredith's family?
Yeah, always. I will always.
Her parents have passed, correct?
Yes, both of her parents have passed. So there's her siblings. She has three siblings, two brothers and a sister. And I would love the opportunity to, you know, one day get to reconcile with them and grieve with them. And I hope they watch this series. I don't know if they will. But I'm never going to close that door.
Yeah.
You know,
when we first met, you talked about how when you get asked to speak publicly, because there's an endless fascination with this case, with this story, you get asked to tell the whole story and it breaks your heart every time you have to do it.
Mm.
Does it feel like maybe getting this sort of mainstream media telling of the story out there on your terms, the facts as you know them, will turn that? Do you think maybe that when you get asked to speak in public, you won't have to recount the worst thing that ever happened to you?
Or
you can move on to another dimension of it?
I mean, I think that, I guess if I'm looking back on what my experience with this has been, I do know that when the Netflix documentary came out, there was a definite shift in people's approach to me, where, like, before the Netflix documentary, I felt like the only thing anyone ever wanted to do was interrogate me, and they didn't actually want to hear what I had to say, and they didn't, they certainly weren't going to empathize with me. So what was the point? Like, I felt very much like my voice didn't matter because no one was going to listen to it just because it was mine. And then right after the Netflix documentary came out, came the first ever request from someone for me to give a talk, just me. So there, and then that, you know, kickstarted my journey into telling my story in a public way.
Mm-hmm. You didn't seek that out. It just kind of came to you.
It came to me. And I was, you know, I've been deeply grateful for those opportunities because, if anything, they've made me feel more connected to humanity again. Like, prior to that opportunity, which is actually where I first met Monica, and she, you know, gave me a pep talk, and she, this woman who had been diminished and vilified, was writing these Vanity Fair articles and doing her TED talk and sort of giving me an idea that there was a path forward where I could reclaim some sense of ownership and authorship over my own life. That was the start. And so I guess, you know, I've been so much in the making of this for so long that I haven't even done the process of having hopes or dreams about what it's going to look like on the other side of it. But now that you mention it, like, I am curious about how this show, which is so beautiful and so well done, might lead to a shift in my ability to like talk about it in a different way. I do know that like these things that happen to us don't just go away, right? Like I'll be carrying, there's not a day in this life that I do not think about what happened to me in Italy. And it gives me perspective that is very helpful for me on a day-to-day basis. So in that way, I'm still going to think about it and probably still going to talk about it. But,
you know, there's a shorthand that you have, or maybe a shortcut with people who know all the intimate details of the nuts and bolts of the wrongful conviction, et cetera. Like when we talk to you two, we can get into some really, you know, deep metaphorical and philosophical discussions about what it all means. But if someone doesn't know, you know, Amanda will go on a podcast sometimes, they'll be like, tell me about that day when you came home to the house. What did you see? And it's like, okay, right. You want me to relive the morning of discovering the crime scene yet again for the 100th time because you didn't watch the Netflix documentary, et cetera.
And do your homework.
Yeah. And now I think one of the big things this might do is just a much bigger audience will have had an opportunity to really follow all those cognitive biases, see how that stuff unfolded. And I think when you do talk to people or when you're telling your story, there'll be just a different higher level of familiarity with the nuts and bolts of the story. So you won't have to spend your time recounting those things and you can leap ahead into the more interesting philosophical territory.
Right.
Which is what your new book, Free, My Search for Meaning, is all about.
Totally.
It's all about what came after all of this and what you learned. And that's really, I think, what's fascinating about your story is that there was this healing and this afterlife that turned into all of these things. And now you do this series on resilience on the Waking Up app. And there's all these things. And you're a storyteller and a journalist. You guys do Hard Knocks with Amanda Knox. I think you're going to get to really just dive into your storytelling and journalism work.
And hopefully, you know, have the opportunity to do what Monica did for me, which was help shepherd someone else in the process of telling their story.
That would give you a new legitimacy as Monica's series did for her.
Yeah.
Tell us again about the Vashon Theater event.
Yes. So,
August 30th, 7 p.m., ticket sales benefit the Washington Innocence Project. And there will be the first two episodes of the show will be screened, followed by a Q&A with Amanda and myself. Amanda will also be available to sign copies of her book, Free My Search for Meaning, which if you missed her reading here on Vashon a few months ago, please come by and get a book. Amanda's happy to sign it and take a selfie with you.
Maybe bring some tissues just in case. Episode 2 is
for you
intense.
Or for them,
but definitely for me.
And probably like, I don't know, a content warning of some kind, like this, it gets intense.
Yeah.
And especially episode 2 is it's the interrogation scene is hard to watch.
That's in episode 2. Okay.
And so I'm not saying don't bring your 12-year-old, but you know, make your judgment call as a parent if you want a younger kid to come watch this because it is intense.
Yeah.
And you mentioning age of viewers, I had a question about what age you feel like your children should attain before you show this to them.
Good question.
Because you know they're going to come up with questions.
Oh yeah, they are. Yeah.
People all around them. But when are they ready to see this? When are they ready to understand?
I mean, all kids are different. So I think I'm just going to have to keep an eye on the kids. Like Eureka is already curious, who's 4. Our daughter Eureka is already curious about the story, but from a more like fairy tale kind of way. I don't think she needs to see anything, because if she's too scared to watch Harry Potter, she's definitely too scared to watch this.
That's the one we're asking. Like, when do we get to watch Harry Potter with her? When can we watch Star Wars with her? Yeah. You know, and it's not yet, because she'll be bored. You know, and I don't want her to be bored on her first viewing.
She'll be alternately bored and terrified.
Yes, exactly.
When you make the wrong call on when to show a movie that is precious to you, to your children, if you make the wrong call, it's like,
and it lives with you forever after.
They might never
watch
it,
but it does.
Yeah. Which is another thing. And as people, you know this as content makers yourself, that you can't expect the people in your life, even the closest people, your own children, to consume all the stuff that you make. Right? And so, like, I mean, I'm thinking, I've wondered, will Eureka ever read my novels? Will Echo read all the poems I've written over the years? You know, what about the thousands of hours of audio that we've made in podcasting? Are they going to meticulously sit through and listen to all the interviews Amanda's ever conducted with people?
Probably not.
You know, and they might not even read her books. Like, her mom doesn't even, you know, her family is like, I lived it, you know, and I think a part of them wants some distance from it, but you know, that it might be the case that they don't want to connect with us in that way, mediated through that.
But it's important that it's there.
It is there.
And it's important that it's there for them when they're ready, if they ever get ready.
They might not be ready until they're 17 or 18 or the age you were when you went to Italy.
Yeah. I wonder if she'll get, when she studies it, when she asks to study abroad, then I'll be like, all right, maybe you have to watch this
first. Let's sit down for the next.
You're like, oh, Mom.
Here's your orientation video. It has 8 episodes. This has been great. It always is. Amanda Knox, Chris Robinson, thank you for being here.
Jeff and Cindy Hoyt, thank you for being here.
For taking a little intermission with us in between your opening week's interviews in LA and the one you're heading for in New York tomorrow morning.
Got to finish that laundry.
Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing you when you get back from all that and can live your lives again.
Yeah, we'll see. We're busy. We got a lot of stuff in the works. So
okay.
Stay tuned.
We'll see you when we see you. From an island in the upper left-hand corner of the lower 48, that's Hoytus Interruptus.
I'm Cindy Hoyt.
And I'm Jeff Hoyt.